This is full-time Catholic radio for Southeast Michigan, 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
Hudson, welcome to Church and Culture. This show is devoted to exploring the interaction between our faith and our culture. Each week, I will talk with expert guests on topics ranging from literature, art, and music to politics, liturgy, spirituality, and education. Thank you for joining us. It's my pleasure to welcome Father John O'Malley to Church and Culture. Father O'Malley is a Roman Catholic priest and a member of the Society of Jesus. He is presently university professor in the theology department at Georgetown University here in Washington, D.C. He's a historian, began with the Italian Renaissance intellectuals and moved on to religious history, and specifically the history of Catholicism, and especially, and the Jesuits, but also of the specific councils, the three great councils of the Church, Trent, Vatican I, Vatican II. I could spend the entire segment introducing him. He really deserves it. His achievement is quite profound in the area of what we could broadly call Church history. I will mention, however, he got his doctorate from Harvard in 1965, He's taught at the University of Detroit, at Western Jesuit School of Theology, and at Georgetown. He's taught at Harvard as well, his alma mater. And 2 years ago, Harvard awarded him its Centennial Medal, which recognizes alumni who have made extraordinary contributions. It's their highest honor. And I can tell you from reading the book we're about to discuss, I would have voted for that too. But I will mention, before we start talking about this particular book, that Father O'Malley has written many, and the best known are The First Jesuits, What Happened at Vatican II. These are all Harvard University Press, basically. Trent, What Happened at the Council There, and A History of the Jesuits, A History from Ignatius to the Present. Father O'Malley, it's time for you to talk, and I want to welcome you to the show.
I'm delighted to be here, and gee, I was impressed by that list you gave.
I know, but you deserve it, so what can I say?
Good.
I became a Catholic at age 34. I'm now 68. And I think I learned more about my church from reading your book on Vatican I than from any single book I have read. It really put my conversion in context of a lot of things that I didn't understand at the time, nor for many years afterward, because I came into the church under the influence of Aquinas and Jacques Maritain, even his much debated volume, The Peasant of the Garonne. And so I'm sure you know what that meant in terms of my various convictions and attitudes and influences. But you in this book, Vatican I, which took place in 1869 and 1870 under Pius IX in Rome, you took me back to really the source of a lot of the conflicts that I dealt with personally in my life as a Catholic since 1984. And I think that our listeners, if they're anything like me, and I know some of them are, they would really be interested in what it is you have to say in this book. So, shall we begin?
Let's begin. But before we do, let me say something about my book on Vatican II, all right?
Mm-hmm.
So the second chapter is called The Long 19th Century. So many of the things that I cover in the book on Vatican I that we're going to discuss now are there kind of in germ, and in a broader perspective in that book on Vatican II. So that's just a little plug. That's a commercial.
Well, I just ordered it as I put down your book on Vatican I. I ordered your book on Vatican II. So look forward to getting another email from me asking for more time on the radio with you.
That's good.
Because your last little chat section in this book, you connect Vatican I and Vatican II. In fact, I was going to read, as a way of beginning this conversation, what you said in the few end pages of the book when you compared the one council to the other. Here it is. You write, "If Vatican I taken in globo was a statement against the modern world, Vatican II was an act of reconciliation with that world." So let's start there.
Okay.
Vatican I. The situation is this. We have, just prior to Vatican I, the publication of The Essence of Christianity by Ludwig Feuerbach, that basically says our understanding of God is based upon a projection out of human need. In 1856, we get The Life of Jesus Critically Examined by David Strauss, one of the first historical critical treatments of the New Testament. In 1848, we get the Communist Manifesto, plus revolutions in France, Germany, Austria, and Italy. And to crown it all, in 1859, we get Darwin's Origin of Species, which tells us we all came, you know, from apes. So I guess that's Pope Pius the Ninth had pretty good reason to be concerned. Is that correct?
Well, yes. I mean, I think thinking people, good Christians, this was a challenge. In my opinion, this all these things that kind of coalesced in the 19th century, they've been building for a long time, they kind of coalesced after the French Revolution. This was the biggest crisis Christianity had ever faced, because it was Christianity that challenged the very basis upon which the faith was built. So no wonder they were frightened, and no wonder they were seeking for some security in this world, and why they were so repelled by, quote, the modern world. Another thing that needs to be said about this modern world is, as I put it, modernity, or the modern. Well, on one level, the obvious level, that means the way things are right now, right? But in the 19th century, it was also an ideology. There was an ideology that the present's better than the past, that we need to get rid of the past, and so on and so forth. And reason is the ultimate criterion for everything, and so forth. So modernity, or the modern world, was not just all these things together, but it was the kind of the ideology that went with them.
By the way, I failed to mention, Father, that the book from Harvard University Press, hot off the press, Vatican I, the Council on the Making of the Ultramontane Church. And I happen to know what that word meant, ultramontane. But you might explain to our listeners, since that's the focus of your subtitle, why is ultramontane so important?
Well, first of all, Harvard University Press did not like that word. They said, you know, nobody will know what it means and so forth. And I said, that's right. Some people will. Most people won't. But it's the word that was used in the era. I can hardly talk about this stuff without talking about it. And they'll learn something. This might pique their curiosity. So what does ultramontane mean? It was a word that began in Italy in the Middle Ages, ultramontane, beyond the mountains, meaning north of the Alps. So popes who were ultramontane, popes who came from northern Europe, then the 17th and 18th century, it got turned around. It meant on the other side of the Alps, namely looking at it from the north, looking south. So ultramontane meant south, meant Italy, meant Rome. So If you were ultramontane, that meant that you looked to papal authority as a way, to a degree that was uncommon in the era. So we live in an ultramontane church. We know the Pope. We think of the Pope. We talk about what the Pope has said yesterday and today. But that's new.
That's new in respect to the entire history of the church.
The entire history of the church, right.
In fact, throughout, you remind the reader that prior to this definition and promulgation of the notion of papal infallibility, the church was for lack of a better term, run in a conciliar way. That is, in the basis of the cooperation of bishops and in the regularity of councils that would meet to discuss central issues.
Right, and that's how that's the big history of the church. You began to have councils in the second century, local councils, and then in 325, the first ecumenical church-wide council. And at that first church-wide council, Nicaea, the Pope was not even present. Now, they respected, gave special respect, of course, to the successor of Peter and so forth, and he had authority, but it wasn't. The church was much more conciliar or collegial in the way it was run than it came to be by after the 19th century.
But so, that doesn't mean there wasn't a head, right?
No, absolutely not, no. And, for instance, in the Middle Ages, you had a wonderful cooperation between the bishops and the popes. When the popes thought there was really a serious problem, they convoked a council. So, on an average, in the Middle Ages, there was an ecumenical council about every 40 years. But when the Great Western Schism occurred, when, for complicated reasons, there were three men contending to be the Pope at the same time, the only way that could be resolved was through a council, and they had to take the radical step of deposing two popes and forcing the third to resign and electing a new pope. So, from that time forward, there began to be this kind of tension between councils and collegial and the monarchical, you might say. So that, and so finally, it's Vatican II really is the council that tried to put that back together again.
Well, they, as you point out throughout the book, Father O'Malley, I want to remind our listeners, we're talking about his new book on Vatican I from Harvard. The drive toward the majority of bishops and cardinals at Vatican I, again, 1869 to 1870, was in response, a very aggressive response to modernity, as represented by Darwin, as represented by Marx, as represented by David Strauss, Feuerbach. You could go back Hegel.
Sure.
You could go back to Kant. And the issue of where do we get our certain knowledge?
Right.
Where is our authority come from? And the denial of transcendence in many of the German idealists, although Schelling did come around later on.
Yeah.
They wanted to, as it were, lock in, right? They wanted to lock in Catholic truth. And they wanted to lock it in by saying, there is one person, one chair, one office in the church that always gets it right when he is speaking as what? As Christ.
Yeah.
And I asked you in a question by email, how do you really explain in simple terms this definition of papal authority that they came up with?
Well, basically what they said was that when the Pope speaks as head of the church solemnly, so ex cathedra, so from the technical term, solemnly, to declare something of divine and apostolic faith, that is to say, goes back to the teaching of Christ and the apostles, at least implicitly, he cannot err. He cannot make a mistake. It's infallible. So those are a lot of pretty big conditions, pretty heavy conditions.
They're also, aren't they vague?
They're vague, sure. So, as all these things are, that's the problem. That's the problem with human life. So they're vague. So you need historians, you need theologians, you need philosophers, and so forth to help us figure out just when and how, when that takes place. So I think we do have two clear. The standard examples are clear. I think the Pius IX's definition of the Immaculate Conception, and then.
But that was prior to...
Well, yes, because... So, what happened... So, papal infallibility, this was not a new idea by any means. This idea, that first of all, that the Roman Church was a sure guide in matters of faith, this goes back to antiquity. The Roman Church, that means the Church of the City of Rome, that means... that the spokesperson there is the bishop, that this goes all the way back. And then when you get to the 16th century with the Protestant controversy and so forth, or actually before that, to this idea of, well, yes, the Church of Rome, the spokesperson of the Church of Rome, can speak in a definitive way, and infallible. They began to use the word infallible. But it was not, you might say it was a theological opinion. It was not held by everybody in the Catholic Church.
It was kind of written in lemon juice, as we used to say.
Yeah, well, and it was debated among theologians.
Mm-hmm.
It was in a cloister of academe.
It wasn't used as a club to beat the culture with.
It was not used as a club to beat the culture with, right. So Well, that's what happens in the 19th century, as you mentioned in your email. The press was, and that was a big surprise to me when I was doing the research on the book, was the influence of the press.
Mm-hmm.
So infallibility, the definition of infallibility, was a grassroots movement. It did not come from the Holy See. Once it got going, the Holy See was happy with it. But it did not come from the Holy See. The Holy See was sort of responded to it. It's pretty good.
By the way, does that make it more palatable if you're someone who looks upon the promulgation of papal infallibility as a less than happy step in the life of the Church? Does the fact that it was a grassroots movement make it more sort of acceptable?
Well, I think it depends upon the people who... for some people, yes. For some people, no. It certainly, I mean, to argue in favor, yes, this was not imposed. This was something that came from... And it's a European thing, basically. The people, the bishops in the United States, the people in the United States, they're kind of out of that controversy, out of that whole... controversy. And
Father, it kind of reminds me of the energy that got Trump elected.
Yes, right. So, yeah. So
it was a lot of fear. There was a lot of confusion, a lot of wanting to get back to what we used to have. Right,
right. Fear and a sense of loss, a big
yes.
sense of loss. And so an attempt to recover something that, I mean, one of the big ironies for me of the Catholic Church officially in the 19th and 20th century, especially the 19th century, is this kind of nostalgia for the good old days of the monarchies before democracy and republican form and so forth. Well, gosh, in the 18th century, the monarchies were terrible regarding the Holy See. I mean, they were, as you know from that first chapter of the book,
yeah,
they were out to get the Holy See and to reduce it to kind of nothing more than a symbol. So nostalgia for the past, you know, it's has a lot of problems.
Yeah, and so you have this, you have a multi-level reaction, set of reactions that inform those, as you say, this worldwide panoply of bishops and cardinals, the first real international meeting of the Catholic Church in its history, was really so remarkable. You had people traveling for a month or more, some on foot, to make their way to Rome in 1869. Of course, getting there, and there's no air conditioning and heat waves and rainstorms, and a meeting place in St. Peter's where nobody can hear. And of course, it's all in Latin in the first place, which I'm sure wasn't on the tip of everyone's tongue, even in 1869.
Amen.
So they're there for many reasons. They're there because they want to avoid schism. They want to make a public response statement, powerful statement about the truth of the Catholic faith in the face of the revolutionaries, in the face of the skeptics, in the face of the new atheism as represented by Darwin. And yet, in the drama, by the way, the drama of the book is great because you pull out all the leaders. Manning sticks out, you know, a lot, Cardinal Manning. But you know what? And I want to ask you this. Pius IX doesn't come off so well in this story.
Well, poor Pius IX. no, the poor man, first of all, he had the longest reign in the history of the papacy. And at the point of the biggest crisis in the history of the papacy, in the history of the church, I think, and also a crisis in the history of Italy, because, as you know from the book, this was precisely when the papal states were seized and when the Italian government seized the city of Rome, which had been a papal city since really the time of Gregory the Great in the 5th century, 5th or 6th century. So the poor man faced tremendous challenges. Secondly, he was not well. I mean, he came from a minor nobility, but he had a very mediocre education, the barest philosophical and theological education. So, and he had certain personality traits too. He was very congenial. He was very charming, not as bright as he could be, and not equipped to, I mean, who was equipped, really, to deal with these challenges of the modern world? So he got nervous, and some of the, especially his actions with Cardinal Guidi in the council are kind of shocking.
Yes.
But, you have to say, well, let's show a little compassion to the guy.
Right. Yeah, I was quite disappointed, if you can be disappointed 200 years later? No, 150 years later. That the Pope, any Pope, would treat his bishop or his cardinals in the way he did. And, of course, I was disappointed in the way he sort of rigged the council, Vatican I, to come out with the result that he wanted.
Yeah, well, I think rigged may be a little bit too strong, but the minority bishops, the ones who did not want the definition, they could never quite believe how opposed he was to them.
Yes.
They just didn't compute with them, that despite all the evidence. So he was a blatant partisan during the council. So, especially as time was, the council moved along. So that's not good for a pope. On the other hand, I mean, I think part of the tragedy of that is the council would almost certainly have made some kind of a statement on infallibility, and probably pretty much along the line that it finally did. Because the minority bishops were really a minority. Generously 150 out of 700, and then that number diminished as the council went on. And they had plenty of opportunities to make their case, but it didn't succeed. So it's And Manning, too, Cardinal, then Archbishop Manning, who was such a kind of a manipulator in the council, it's too bad he did that because
he didn't need to do it.
He didn't need to do it, no.
We're talking...
of course, you know, this is all hypothetical. I mean...
Well, as you lay it out, I mean, I nodded my head immediately when you say there would have been some sort of definition regardless of how the Pope at the time, Pope Pius IX, regardless of how rude he was or how much he had sort of, as I put it, rigged the thing, with, especially with the election of the original, what do they call them?
Deputations?
Yeah, deputations, who really were, you know, they were the gatekeepers of the council, correct?
Yeah. Well, actually, he didn't rig that deputation. I mean, that was rigged by Manning. You know?
Okay, sorry.
Yeah.
That's true. I remember now. And the minority weren't really organized against him.
Yeah. The poor minority, they were not organized. Now, Lord Acton, the great Lord Acton. So, I mean, one of the ironies of Vatican I is two key players were two Englishmen,
right.
Which is not what you would expect. And one was the Archbishop of Westminster, Archbishop Manning. The other was the layman, Acton, and Acton was on the other side. So
the other side.
Acton was the man who organized the minority as much as they ever got organized, but they never could really get their act together all the way through the council.
Father, we're going to take a short break. We're talking about your new book, Vatican I, The Council and the Making of the Ultramontane Church, from Harvard. It's a great book. And, by the way, it's so readable. It can be read by anybody on all levels. It's beautifully written, short sentences, which I appreciate. And it's only 240 pages. It reads very easily. I strongly recommend it. I left a review on Amazon for everybody to make up their mind. So we'll be back with Father John O'Malley, theology professor at Georgetown, after a brief break.
On the next Cresta in the Afternoon.
Is it possible to be a successful business leader and also incorporate your faith into your business dealings? How can we make tough business decisions and still heed God's call to generosity, compassion, and empathy? We'll discuss that as well as What the Saints Never Said. Trent Horn joins us from Catholic Answers.
Cresta in the Afternoon from 4 to 6 on 990 Ave Maria Radio.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popcha.
Do you know the best way to get kids to obey? Remain calm. In the words of St. John Bosco, quote, show your children that uncontrolled emotion plays no part in your actions. They will respect you for that, and their respect will prompt their obedience, end quote. It turns out research agrees. In fact, studies show that the louder you yell, the less kids listen to what you say, and the more they just treat you like you're crazy. That might cause kids to keep their heads down around you, but it won't help them learn from you. Remaining calm helps you become the parent your kids want to learn from, instead of just avoid. Need help developing calm discipline strategies? Check out Parenting with Grace, the Catholic Parent Guide to Raising Almost Perfect Kids. I'm Dr. Greg Popchak, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
Ever thought you'd make a bundle by trading in or selling your used vehicle only to find out it's worth a dinner for two? Well, it's much more valuable to donate your vehicle to Ave Maria Radio. Thousands of Americans donate their vehicle each year. The donation to Ave Maria is easy, tax-deductible, and supports our efforts to evangelize. A year from now, will you remember that dinner or your gracious and selfless donation? Go to AveMariaRadio.net to find out more. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
Father John O'Malley teaches theology in Georgetown, one of the church's most prominent church historians. We're talking about his latest book on Vatican I from Harvard. Father, I think you could give our listeners a pretty good feel of what it was like inside the controversy at the council over defining papal infallibility, if you tell the story of Cardinal Filippo Maria Guidi.
Yes, well, the one story that many people know about Vatican I is the story of Cardinal Guidi, the incident with between Pope Pius IX and Cardinal Guidi, who was a Dominican cardinal and Archbishop of Bologna. So at the council, the minority were not so much opposed to infallibility as they were to what they thought was an exaggerated interpretation of it that the other side was giving. So they kept saying, you're making this this infallibility personal to the Pope. That is to say, he walks around and anything he says, he's an infallible person rather than an infallible office. And you're making it separate from the Church, as if he doesn't have to pay any attention to the Church, as if he can do whatever he wants. So this is our problem with it, that the decree is open to this kind of exaggerated interpretations. So they tried to work out a compromise, but they needed somebody from the majority to build the bridge. So Cardinal Guidi, on his own now, not sponsored by the minority of the council, on his own, gave this speech in which he said, look, here's what it means. It's not personal to the Pope in the sense that he's an infallible person, but it's an infallible office. No, he's not doing this divorce from the Church. He has to be reflecting the faith of the Church. That's what he's doing, in speaking for the Church, in communion with the Church. So, any rate, the leaders of the majority and the leaders of the minority were extremely happy. I mean, most of them were from the majority because they felt, oh, now we can move ahead. Now we can solve this division in the council. But that afternoon, Pius IX called Guidi to his office and bawled him out and made the famous statements, I am tradition, which sounds as if he's saying that he is an infallible person, and I am the Church, as if he were independent of the Church. So when word of this spread, it caused consternation, widespread, in both, certainly with the minority of the council, the ones who did not, arguing not in favor of the definition in the same way, and the majority. So it gives you some idea of the kind of tension there was in the council and some of the basic issues that were in play. Is that clear, what I said?
It was very clear, and I think it'll even be clearer if you add a comment on, you know, the way I saw it was he put the knife in, Pius IX, but he twisted it when he insisted on certain canonical language being added at the very last minute, without debate, to the document. What was that language?
Well, without the consent of the Church.
Yeah.
So this is just what the minority was worried about. So, I mean, there are different ways of interpreting what that means, but certainly on the surface, it sounds as if the Pope does not need to consult the Church or be in tune with the Church or reflect the faith of the Church, which of course would be nonsense, but at least that's what it could be interpreted as. So the minority, what's interesting with the leaders of the minority, they were the leaders of some of the most important dioceses in the Church at the time in Europe. So Paris, Munich, Vienna, Prague, Milan, Turin, they They didn't want to embarrass the Pope by voting against the decree, so they finally did a lot of soul-searching and just decided to leave the council without voting.
Now, was this because of the original, just the definition itself, or because of this language that was added at the last minute?
Well, I think it was because of the language. The language that was added at the last minute, and what was not added, what they wanted to add was something like in communion with the church, or
right.
Something like that.
And but
that,
what did they add?
Well, it almost seems to be the opposite. So that was they couldn't take that. They couldn't, in conscience, they felt they.
Yeah, it was a direct rebuke. They came. A group of the minority bishops and cardinals requested a audience with Pius IX. They came and asked for one thing to be removed, one thing to be added. Again, reflecting their desire to state.
They want to stay. They want to stay and vote for it.
Yeah, they wanted this papal infallibility not to be detached from the councils, the church. They didn't want an interpretation of papal infallibility that made him the Lone Ranger, so to speak.
Right, and made him a despot, made him to do anything he wanted to do. That there were no controls, there were no limits to him. But that's what they were against.
Yeah, and so that they had language about in communion with the church, this papal infallibility is enacted in communion with the church. Well, he didn't do it. In fact, he inserted something that underscored the fact that the Pope can pronounce infallibly even apart from the received opinion within the church.
Well, I mean, it's open to that interpretation now. I mean, and you have to say, I've tried to explain in the conclusion of the book that with all these statements of any council or any pope and so forth, so how is it received and how is it interpreted? So what you had after the council was even Pius IX himself had to sort of back down on that. Nothing changed the wording or anything, but back down on that kind of interpretation because of the reaction that, you know, especially Bismarck in Germany. I mean, Bismarck says, okay, now the Pope can do anything. The bishops are nothing.
And now I know where the attitude about John F. Kennedy in 1960 came from.
Sure, yeah, yeah. So, yeah, it's so the whole, just even the word papal infallibility. Well, okay, so the Pope can say anything, and you can't challenge him, and he's almost like a Pope can do and say anything and order any Catholic around. Well, he can't do that.
Well, the document also confirmed his sovereignty or his right to be a political sovereign, to get the papal states back, so to speak.
Well, no, it didn't. I mean, it's amazing to me that this threat to the city of Rome itself was so real during the council. And was a big issue, well, for a long time, but certainly for the previous 10 years, how little role that played in the council itself, except as a threat that they needed to move along and get things done before, as long as they could get things done, and they didn't know what was going to happen if the city was seized by the Italian government. So, but it,
when you say I misinterpreted that. I thought this chapter 3 in Pastor Aeternus did affirm his right to claim that under certain conditions.
No, I think it was his right to oppose laws and so forth that were contrary to so forth. So, but no. It has nothing to do with
okay. Well, I'm glad I clarified
yeah,
on that.
Yeah, yeah.
And a few other things that really concerned me as I read was the attitude toward religious liberty. I mean, as you put so in your book, the declaration in Vatican I on religious liberty, and that in Vatican II are diametrically opposed. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, there's nothing in either the two documents of the Council. I mean, the Dei Filius, the one on against rationalism and then in favor of faith, or the one on primacy and infallibility. What are we talking about now? I forget.
Religious liberty.
Religious liberty, yes. So religious liberty, what did that bring? I mean, and to the eyes of Catholics of the 19th century, liberty, equality, fraternity, that had upset everything.
Mm-hmm.
And and indeed it had introduced, for their viewpoint, a political chaos. And the people who, many of the people who were advocating this religious liberty were anti-church. It was not very understandable that they would be opposed to it. When you get to the time of Vatican II, the whole political situation had changed. I mean, the whole cultural situation had changed. So, I mean, even at the time of the Council, at the time of the Council, many Catholics were saying, take a look at the United States. Take a look at Belgium. These are countries where there is religious liberty, and the church is doing just fine.
Yes, yes.
So, but, you know, they were lonely voices.
Now, since we have established that the, you know, one major purpose of Vatican II, of both the documents of Vatican II, and we should remind our listeners that there was not just this one on infallibility, but one on what, on the Son?
Well, it's on faith, really.
On faith. And was to respond to and in some way grapple with modernity. Do you think Vatican I at the end of the day was successful in ameliorating the influence of modernity or providing another point of view or slowing it down?
Well, I don't think Vatican II, I don't think Vatican I had anything to do with either ameliorating it or slowing it down or accelerating it or anything like that. It was modernity's here to stay. I mean, modernity's the way things are. So,
yes.
The good thing about Vatican II is we said, okay, that's the way things are. Let's see how we can deal with it. Vatican I was more or less a rejection of it in the hopes of reversing it. But even with that, which was kind of a misguided idea, the document on faith is a good and necessary document because in this age, when it looked as if it was going to be heading towards total godlessness, it didn't need God, all the standard traditional values were being shaken, that is a statement about faith, the transcendent destiny of the human person. So it's not a perfect document.
Well, call it the overlooked document.
Yeah, because everybody focuses on the document on papal primacy and infallibility. That's Vatican I. Well, no, it's not. There's this other document that is also important in its age, and to some extent also for our age. I mean, not put it in the same terms, but it was a statement of faith and the importance of faith and the validity of faith in an age when that was really being questioned by all intelligence.
It reaffirmed revelation, but also just the concept of there being transcendental reality. That
right.
Not just not the material.
It's not all here now. It's not all material.
Yeah. In fact, the parts of that you quoted, I found very, very moving.
Yeah. And no, it's, it misses a few points, key points that you wish it had dealt with, but no, it was a statement that needed to be made, and they made it. So good for them.
The one question I wanted to ask Father O'Malley is that the going forward toward Vatican II, so you have between what, 1870, and when was the Vatican II Council?
Well, it opened in 1962. So basically, we're talking 100 years. We're talking basically 100 years.
You say we now live in an ultramontane church. How did the popes between the two councils handle that new, how you say it, the new visibility?
Well, as I say in the book, the seizure of the Papal States and the city of Rome, and then the other political upheavals that the church denounced, turned out to be very happy tragedies for the papacy, because it liberated them from some of this being a king and a monarch in the papal states, and at the same time broke down some of the old traditions. So, I mean, for instance, in Italy's a good example. So the unification of Italy, what that did, that destroyed all these smaller states, about nine of them, each one of which had arrangements with the Holy See about the appointment of bishops, in each one of which the local authorities had an important say in the appointment of the bishops. Well, once they disappeared, those concordats, those arrangements, disappeared with them. So the Pope had complete freedom in appointing bishops. The same thing happened with France much later. So what we take for granted today, for instance, is that the Pope appoints bishops, and he appoints them pretty freely with consultation and so forth, but he makes the appointments. That's new, and that's part of the ultramontane church. That's the church that now so everything or much flows from Rome. So that's the ultramontane church.
You know, why does that feel right to me? I know whenever I've read history, you know, of Europe, I've always been struck by the central role that governments, take France, played in choosing not just bishops but clergy and parishes. I always reacted like that can't be right. Help me understand what reaction is.
That goes all the way back. It's a medieval development, and it's not crazy because the bishops were such important local figures. You want to say political figures or cultural figures and social figures that rulers simply couldn't have any old person come in and do it. So they just felt they had to have some control. And this was good for the papacy, too. If all worked well, there was a balance. There was negotiation. By and large, it worked well, but there were then great cases of scandal and disagreement and so forth. But by and large, it worked well. But then, in the 19th and 20th century, the whole political situation changed. And it no longer made any sense. I think that for me, the one problem today with the popes being so free to choose the bishops is that there needs to be more of a dialogue of some kind going on with the local church. Now, we like to assume that it's going on in some way, some fashion that we don't understand. But certainly that's a balance needs to be there. Because the church is hierarchical, but the church is also collegial. This is the...
Your book really helped me to understand. And it really sort of helped me get past the sort of red flags that have gone up in the past, my own thinking, when I hear that language, collegial and so forth.
The church is basically collegial, but also hierarchical. So you have to have that balance. So I'm writing a little book now called The Council Side by Side, putting Trent, Vatican I, and Vatican II
together.
Great
idea.
Yeah. And so one of the chapters is center and periphery. So this whole thing of What's the balance now between, who's in charge? What's the balance between the center, the papacy, and the periphery, let's say the bishops and on down?
Right.
How do you put that together? So that's been a tension, especially in the last 600 years. So,
well, Father O'Malley, when's the last time a pope spoke infallibly?
Well, according to me, Pius XII, of the definition of Assumption. I mean, that, I think that's generally agreed upon by people. Now, other people
So when we hear the fear of papal infallibility thrown around and so forth, the response really is, this is something that is done like once a century. Would that be a good comeback?
Well, if at all. I mean,
if at all, right.
Well, I mean, we don't have any clear examples of it until Pius XI. So, once a century, at most, maybe. Now, you do hear people say, well, this papal document, you know, that's infallible. The Pope.
Right, you hear that all the time.
I beg your pardon?
You hear that about encyclicals all the time.
Yes. So, be careful in using that language. I mean, that puts an awful burden on the Pope and on people. This is apostolic and divine faith. Unless you accepted come on.
It almost sounds like to be a good Catholic, you got to be able to read and understand a papal encyclical every time it comes out.
Well, papal encyclicals, I mean, they've assumed in the last 50 years a kind of authority that they never had before. I mean, they were important. They were had a big influence. But in terms of the hierarchy of documents and so forth that people had to pay attention to, they were down the list. I mean, first of all, you had the Bible, the scriptures. Then you had the councils. Then you had the teaching of common teaching of the church and so forth. Finally, you get down to encyclicals, which were sort of always considered more or less kind of contemporary applications of and statements about crucial issues going on in the church at the time. But so important to be reverenced, to be, but they weren't, didn't have the kind of exalted standard that they've gotten in the last 50 years.
You know, I really hope our listeners are listening closely to this, because we've got to put to rest the idea that every time the Pope speaks, from his Wednesday audiences to his letters to his apostolic declarations to encyclicals, that we have to run around, you know, like the papal infallibility police, you know, and figure out which statement is and isn't, because clearly people don't understand or they wouldn't be looking for it.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Yes. So, and it's very dangerous. I mean, it's, you know, the way infallibility, the word infallibility is thrown around today, it's very dangerous. I'm against it.
Father O'Malley, yeah, and I am too, because it's it really bucks the point. It's as if people are trying to look at, well, what is it my duty? Just tell me the bottom line and I'll do it, right?
Yeah, right.
It jumps over the need to think, to reflect, you know, to...
To reflect and to read, and to listen to people whose judgment you trust, and to try to look at both sides of things. You know, that's something we really need today. I mean, I was just at a conference over the weekend, and people were talking about the verbal violence of the day of today.
Oh, it's off the charts.
It's off the chart. Verbal violence, and that Catholics should not engage in that.
I don't want to read the news anymore, you know, religious or otherwise.
No.
Father O'Malley, I want to take the last minute and remind listeners that your book is Vatican II, The Council and the Making of the Ultramarine Church. Oh, gosh, I'm sorry. You're right. Vatican I. I was thinking of Vatican II because I was going to say, after I've read your book on Vatican II, you'll come back and talk to me about it?
I sure will.
I'd be delighted, because I'm learning a lot from reading this book, and I want to continue and read Trent, and I want to read your new book. When will your new book be out?
Well, I've got a draft done, and I'm submitting it to the press on in my deadline is the 1st of September. I haven't done before.
Okay, well, I won't get in the way of that. But once again, Father John O'Malley, university professor in the theology department at Georgetown, internationally recognized church historian, Jesuit priest. Thanks for being on Church and Culture with me today.
It's been a delight. I'm so glad you invited me.
I am too, and I look forward to having you again in the near future. We'll talk about Vatican II.
Excellent.
And to all of you who are listening, I'll be back after this break with another wonderful guest.